You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by sigmasport.co.uk, the UK's leading road cycling store. Use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout to receive £10 off your next order of £50 or more.
Hello, I'm Jo Wood, and I'm so fond of the cycling podcast that I wrote a love letter to it. Awkward. Their blend of intelligence, integrity and passion greatly enhances my understanding and enjoyment of cycling. Thank you for joining me on countless commutes, training runs and during my working day when I need to be distracted by some familiar, friendly voices.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello.
Hello, chaps. You well?
Very well, thanks. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, very well. We're doing one of these sort of remote podcasts again, all three of us in separate locations. Are you in a secret location again, Daniel, or can you divulge your whereabouts?
I am. That's why you can't see me. That's why I've turned my camera off on Skype, Richard.
I thought there was a reason for that. Well, I can see Lionel sitting there with an old-fashioned receiver pressed to his ear. That's very, very nice, Lionel.
Yeah, we're struggling to get into the swing of this morning, aren't we?
Not really, no.
But yes, I've got a proper telephone. It's just more comfortable to talk on than your sort of NASA-style headphones.
Well, let's crack on, shall we? We've got lots of ground to cover this week from racing, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the last of the spring classics. So we're starting to look ahead towards the Giro. We've got some exciting news about the Giro, haven't we, chaps? And then we have a controversial story to cover as well, the suspension of Shane Sutton following a few days of controversy. That is a rapidly sort of developing and escalating story, but we will cover that later in the podcast. But first of all, as is traditional, can you give us our news roundup, Lionel?
I can indeed, Rich. Yes, the spring classics have come to an end. Alejandro Valverde won Flèche Wallonne for a record fourth time, third year in a row for the Spanish rider. He won ahead of the Etics Quickstep pair, Julian Alaphilippe and Daniel Martin. Anna van der Breggen of Rabo Live ended Bols Dolman's dominance of the Women's World Tour by winning the women's edition of Flèche Wallonne. However, Bols Dolman's American duo Evelyn Stevens and Megan Guarnier did take the other two places on the podium. Sky's Mikel Landa warmed up for the Giro d'Italia by beating Astana's Tanel Kangert by a couple of seconds to win the Giro del Trentino Melinda. Kangert won two stages and his Astana team won the opening team time trial, and Landa won the other stages as Astana and Sky swept up. At the Tour of Croatia, Trek's Giacomo Nizzolo won a couple of stages, Mark Cavendish won again, and the overall honours there went to a home rider, the Croatian Matija Kasvina. Wout Poels, who'd been fourth at Flèche Wallonne, won Sky's first one-day monument at a snowy Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Lots of other news off the bike this week as well. The young Belgian cyclocross rider Femke van den Driessche, who was caught with a motorised bike in the under-23 Women's World Championship cyclocross earlier this year, has been banned for 6 years. The Australian rider Michael Rogers, a former world time trial champion, former Sky rider and Tinkoff rider, has retired with a heart problem. And we've heard this week, or it's had it confirmed this week, that Scotland's Brian Smith is set to leave Dimension Data at the end of the month.
Thank you, Lionel. Very comprehensive news roundup there. We'll return to some of these topics later on, but will we start with Liège-Bastogne-Liège? Let's start with the racing. Wout Poels, I mean, I said that maybe few people would have imagined him as Sky's first monument winner, but he's a very talented rider. Joined the team last year, had a few years of real adversity. He was involved in a terrible crash on the stage to Metz in the 2011 Tour de France. You know, he suffered terrible internal injuries. There were no sort of external signs of injury, but he had a part of his kidney removed. And you know, he's done extremely well to come back. When he did come back, Vacansoleil collapsed, and then he joined Quickstep for a year, and then he joined Sky and became a very valued member of the sort of Grand Tour squad at Sky, but also a winner in his own right. He won a stage at Tirreno Adriatico last year, I remember, and now he's won Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Did you see that coming, Daniel?
Well, he's the prototype of a Sky success story, isn't he, really? They picked him up from Etics Quickstep, didn't they? Or what was Quickstep at the time. And a guy whose talent and potential had perhaps not been fully acknowledged, not been fully exploited, certainly. But I can remember very shortly after they signed him, Dave Brailsford raving about how explosive he was and what a perfect fit he was for the Ardennes Classics. And you know, they've really developed him, and it is a surprise in the sense that he wasn't necessarily even the rider most people thought would lead Sky in the Ardennes Classics, but it's very much in line with his performances since he's been at Sky, isn't it? And, you know, with the addition of the Vanity signing, Kwiatkowski, who was very helpful on the day, wasn't he? He wasn't in particularly good form. He hasn't been in particularly good form in the Ardennes, but, you know, I'm sure Sky will be delighted with the 3 million euros they spent for him to lead Poles out at the bottom of a couple of climbs.
Well, I was going to say, Wout Poels is the sort of anti-vanity signing, isn't he? He's the opposite of a vanity signing. But tremendous value. I should correct myself, actually. That crash on the road to Metz was in 2012, not 2011. So he's done extremely well to come back and is perhaps showing his potential. Now, that race, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, was the third in the trilogy of almost Ardennes classics, if we include Amstel Gold. As has been the pattern the last few years, and you like your patterns, Lionel, they didn't provide a sort of rousing second act to the cobbled classics, which were thrilling this year, as they have been in recent years. They were damp squibs, weren't they, generally, and all came down to a final, you know, kilometre or so. This race was a little bit different, because and I feel that Michael Albasini, who was second, deserves some credit for dragging that group clear. In doing so, he perhaps costs himself a better chance of winning the race, and Wout Poels perhaps owes him something for that. But, you know, it was set to be another quite big group sprint again, wasn't it, which we would have fancied Alejandro Valverde for, although Warren Barguil rode extremely well to come in at the head of that group in sixth. Did Liège-Bastogne-Liège, was it the best of the three of the Ardennes classics, do you think, Lionel?
Well, it probably was, in the sense that the weather gave an interesting backstory. I mean, quite a dramatic turnaround from Flèche Wallonne, which was lovely and sunny and looked like the Tour de France in July, and then snow, sleet and freezing conditions at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Didn't quite live up to the thought that perhaps we were in for a repeat or rerun of the 1980 edition, the famous 1980 edition won by Bernard Hinault. I think the difficulty is that the level of the peloton these days is so high that you can have a situation where you're coming to the final four or five climbs and there's still a large group of riders in contention, even if, you know, three quarters of those riders have got no realistic chance of winning. They're still there. They're still, you know, there's still this sense that the peloton is almost dragging and holding back the main contenders, and so that inevitably leads to a sense of caution and a sense that the only way to really win the race is to wait till the very final moment. So I think Daniel Martin said in the run up to the race that Liège-Bastogne-Liège is like playing a game of poker, and really one false move, or if you show your hand at the wrong time, it's game over, and there is more caution in a race like Liège-Bastogne-Liège because there isn't the same level of unpredictability that the cobble classics can throw up.
Why is the race won like this now? Because in the past, in the olden days, there were sort of devastating attacks and solo victories or small groups coming to the line. I remember even, you know, just a few years ago, the Schleck brothers and Philippe Gilbert arriving together. Why now is it a much bigger group? Is it because so many riders are so equally matched, and why is that different now than it was, say, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago?
Well, Richard, I don't know if you know what happened in the 1990s in cycling, but no, I think in all seriousness, I think, you know, I mean, I'm harking back here to the, for example, the 1999 race where Frank Vandenbroek absolutely devastated everyone on La Redoute. I think he rode a part of it in the big ring. And, you know, we should really be quite grateful that we don't see that sort of massacre anymore. And that could only take place probably because of EPO.
But going back to the 80s, just, you know, it'd be small groups, you know, the year Sean Kelly won, or in 89, I remember Robert Miller being up the road. You know, it was one of those races, a bit like Milan-San Remo, where you saw this combination of different types of rider. You saw it was the first time you saw some of the Grand Tour riders come to the fore in a one-day race, and you also saw some of the survivors of spring, if you like, the survivors of the Cobble Classic still riding quite well. Have they become more specialist?
I think the comparison you make there, Richard, with sort of the 80s, the difference in the course then was that they used to run back into the centre of Liège. And I think that the uphill finish does compel people to wait. You know, even on Sunday's race, the four guys got away and they're all waiting for that sprint finish, aren't they? Is the gap big enough to enable us to mess about a lot or mess about a little bit? And as it was on Sunday, they were able to just pause a little bit, and then there was a sprint which Poles opened up early and Albasini tried to come past him. It's just a bit too formulaic, I think. And the riders know that it's all about surviving until those last two climbs. And to call the Rue Nanio a cobbled climb, I mean, it's paving stones, really. I thought that was a slightly sort of, not gimmicky introduction, but it wasn't, it's not a cobbled climb as we associate with the Tour of Flanders, for example.
So get rid of the climb at the finish. As with so many stages in the Grand Tours, counterintuitively, races that finish not at the top of a climb often lead to more exciting racing.
Sorry, just need to also say, I mean, Movistar were incredibly strong and they controlled so much of that second half of the race by being an imposing presence on the front of the peloton. And that, although it didn't pay off for Alejandro Valverde on this occasion, that has a nullifying effect as well, because everybody else knows that if they move, they're just going to be ground back down again by a team that is showing such strength in numbers. And had it not been Movistar, it might have been one of the other teams. Perhaps, you know, Sky found that they didn't have to play that role simply because Movistar beat them to it. And I think the rider who deserves the most credit for trying something different is Romain Bardet, who made a very big effort, which, as he was making it, although I knew the result because I wasn't able to watch the race live on Sunday, which makes it a very different experience watching a race knowing that something is doomed to failure. But it was obviously a move that wasn't going to work. I mean, we haven't seen a move like that work for a long period of time. And so you're left with this sense that there will be a sprint finish in Alms come what may, really.
A point worth making, I was over at Flesh making the fourth and final edition of Kilometre Zero, the Survivors of Spring, our series sponsored by Well Bricks. We've released three of these already, two last week, one on Giant Alpecin and one on The Day After Hell, which was Daniel catching up with some riders the day after Paris-Roubaix. I was out there with the Canyon SRAM women's team at Flesh Wallonne. And for all that it might be a slightly sterile spectacle on TV, it's a fantastic experience in the flesh, and it's worth making that distinction. You know, the huge crowds, you get to see a lot of racing, you get to see the riders up close, and on a particularly steep climb, you see quite a lot. And so for the live experience, it's fantastic, but for the TV viewer, perhaps not quite so good. Should we wrap it up there, chaps, because we've got a lot more ground to cover. Let's
Richard, can I say one final thing about the Ardennes?
Yes,
Classic?
You can, Daniel.
I feel that I owe it to our friend, I'm not sure he's a friend of the podcast, but he's an acquaintance of the podcast, the vanity signing, Michał Kwiatkowski. I have no idea how much he's earning at Team Sky. That was purely speculative on my part to suggest that he's earning 3 million euros a year.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
You heard there our Eurosport jingle. Thank you very much to Eurosport for their ongoing sponsorship of the cycling podcast. And coming up on Eurosport over the next week or so is the Tour de Yorkshire, from the 29th of April to the 1st of May. That's the Tour de Yorkshire, not the Tour of Yorkshire. And then next week, 4 days of Dunkirk from the 4th to 8th of May. And of course, beginning on the 6th of May, the Giro d'Italia in Holland, of course, where else? So that's all coming up on Eurosport, the home of cycling, in the next week or so. Now we've got to turn our attentions, chaps, to a less savoury episode, one that, as I mentioned at the start of the show, is still very much developing. I think there's going to be a lot more to come on this. But it's the story that broke at the weekend about Shane Sutton and his treatment of Jess Varnish. That's really when things started to come to a head. But Lionel, can you give us a quick run through of, you know, who Shane Sutton is and, you know, where we are and what's kind of happened to get us to this point?
Well, I'll try to, Rich. Yeah, Shane Sutton is an Australian, a former rider. He won the Milk Race in, I think, 1990. He's a Commonwealth Games gold medalist as a rider. And after retiring, he started working as a coach with Welsh Cycling. And then he joined the British Cycling setup in 2002. And he became the kind of the figurehead coach, didn't he? And his sort of main protégés were the big three, Sir Chris Hoy, Victoria Pendleton and Bradley Wiggins. He had a key role to play in a lot of their success as British cycling went through this incredible revolution from kind of global also-rans into world beaters, certainly on the track. They were world beaters in 2008 and then 2012. He was also employed as a coach at Team Sky when that set up, although he wasn't there for all that long, a couple of years maybe. And after Dave Brailsford's departure from British Cycling as performance director, Shane Sutton stepped up to take the big job. That was in April 2014, although the big job was slightly redefined. Instead of being called performance director, he was called technical director. And the Rio de Janeiro Olympics later on this summer is his first big championships, major event as the head of British Cycling, and everything has been leading towards there. And of course, he's joined that Olympic cycle, or he's taken the reins fully midway through. And so his job was really to keep steering the ship towards Rio and make sure that there were strong medal chances across the board, because that is what is required of British Cycling as a publicly funded body. All of their money has to be spent in a way that is appropriate. There's various rules on who is funded and how they are funded, and there's always been this mantra that you have to really be a medal contender in order to have full Olympic funding. So this all really kicked off when Shane Sutton gave an interview to the Daily Telegraph in which he revealed that Jess Varnish was going to have her Olympic funding cut and effectively would not be a part of the team for Rio. Jess Varnish then gave an interview to the Daily Mail in which she alleged that Shane Sutton had told her to go and have a baby. Shane has denied that he made that comment, but Jess had then released a statement on Facebook in which she backed up and then added to her allegations. And British Cycling announced that they were going to have an internal investigation and would look into the accusations. But then things took a darker turn really overnight, because there was another story in the Mail in which the Paralympian rider Darren Kenny accused Shane Sutton of using really quite offensive language towards Paralympic athletes. And so that's where we are now, with Shane Sutton having been suspended from his role and British Cycling in a state of disarray.
In a state of disarray, certainly. This is a new experience for British Cycling, who have been the sort of golden boys and girls of British sport for the last decade or so, really. All of us know Shane Sutton pretty well, in the sense that we've had dealings with him over the years. And, you know, he's a larger-than-life character, which is a terrible euphemism perhaps to use in this particular context, because if the alleged comments are comments that he has made, they are inexcusable and unjustifiable. There is a certain irony, even hypocrisy, in... You know, it occurred to me the first few days of this week, before the overnight story and the allegations from Darren Kenny about his language towards the Paralympians. But the focus was really on sexism and his alleged sexist remarks to Jess Varnish, and more widely, the allegations made by Nicole Cook and Victoria Pendleton that, you know, the organisation itself is sexist. It's institutionally sexist in a way. You know, there is an irony in this in the media, and I'm not exonerating ourselves from this charge in spending so much time discussing this issue and so very little time on discussing women's racing. You know, you wouldn't find much in any of the newspapers about Lizzie Armitstead's win at Tour of Flanders, for example, and yet a story like this plays big. Now, it's just a point that I think is worth making, and as I say, I don't exonerate us from that charge either. And I think, you know, it's difficult to perhaps discuss the specific allegations about what Shane apparently said, but, you know, the wider point about the sport being sexist is I think one that most of us would probably acknowledge. And in some respects, that's a inevitability of history. You know, that's not to say that you should accept it, and things are changing, but it takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. I think we had a very revealing interview with Rochelle Gilmore in the podcast last year, where she talked extremely well about that that process and that pace of change, and how, you know, patience is required. It doesn't happen overnight. But I mean, just specifically, Lionel, on British cycling, I think one thing that British cycling could have done and hasn't done over the years, as female athletes have become flag bearers for them, from Victoria Pendleton to Laura Trott, has been to appoint women to staff positions. There have been no female coaches or anyone in senior staff positions at British Cycling, as far as I can tell. And that, I think, is quite a failing.
Well, it is, because effectively nothing happens to kind of change and shift the culture of an organisation. And you're quite right, with the level of success, world-class performances from a number of athletes, it is quite surprising that nobody has yet managed to graduate into a senior coaching position. But just on sort of the context of, because this story has kind of, it's galloped along at quite a pace, as these sorts of stories often do. Once somebody makes a public allegation and an individual is kind of down on one knee, others will add where previously they would have felt unable to say anything. And that does certainly appear to be the case in the last sort of 12, 24 hours. We're currently talking on Wednesday morning. A couple of days ago, this was a story about sexism, not just within British cycling, but also within cycling as a whole. And I was just going to sort of add a bit of context, and not by way of an excuse at all, but just to explain that, you know, the World Track Championship started in the 1890s, and it wasn't until 1958 that there were any events for women at all. There was no women's road race at the Olympic Games until 1984. And so, you know, historically, there is a lot of catching up to be done. And I do think that in the last number of years, the last sort of 4 or 5 years, when the pressure has been increased quite significantly from a number of different places, not least the success and the headlines and the coverage generated by the likes of Victoria Pendleton, Nicole Cook, Lizzie Armitstead in this country, it is changing and improving. You know, pressure has been brought to bear. New events like the Tour de Yorkshire have added a women's race. It's small steps. It is very small steps, but necessarily so, I think, because unfortunately the world of sport is an incredibly sort of capitalist place, you know, and there's huge sort of market pressures, and these jumps can't be made in one big go. I think history shows us that can't be done. If it could be done, I think it would have been done, because there's no compelling reason to exclude 50%, 51% of the population from having a greater profile in an elite sport. So the arguments have been made about whether or not British cycling is sort of institutionally sexist, and I would say that there's an Nicole Cook, that there's an uneven playing field is absolutely true, but I don't think it's necessarily for the want of trying. I think it's just progress is not as fast as a lot of people would like.
And Lionel, without going into necessarily the specifics of the Shane Sutton case, because it has escalated and it now looks a lot worse than we first feared, but I would say that, you know, if we want the male cycling community, and that includes us, to adapt and to give women's sport more consideration, you don't really get anywhere by demonising people and telling them they're chauvinist, sexist pigs. I mean, you have to work with, you know, everyone has to work together in this, and we have to work slowly and we have to work gradually, and we'll get there in the end. But it's not for a want of trying on a lot of people's part. Again, in this case with Shane Sutton, we're talking about something much more serious, and the accusations suggest that behaviours might have taken place that were beyond the pale, so to speak. But on a more general point as well, I would say that, you know, Shane Sutton has maintained his place in British cycling because he's been very, very successful. And British cycling have always known what Shane Sutton's modus operandi has been. They've known, I mean, Rich, you used this word about Shane, and he took great exception to this.
I described Shane as abrasive in an article in the Telegraph, actually, and it was during the Tour de France. I was covering it with Lionel, and I got a text message that evening that just said, "Who the f*** are you calling abrasive?" I followed up by saying, "Well, you know, your text message kind of demonstrates the point, I think," and his reply to that was two words, and the second one was off.
I think that just demonstrates that British Cycling have made a call, and they've decided that the juice has been worth the squeeze with Shane Sutton for many, many years. And, you know, Lionel said, it is an organisation and with a funding structure which relies on success at elite level. And they've made no bones about that. They've been quite transparent about the fact that, well, we're talking about an elite sports plan here. And we've all jumped aboard, everyone in Britain who's involved with cycling, we've all been aboard the same gravy train. That includes fans, that includes journalists, that includes people at British Cycling. And as long as they've been winning, they've decided that whatever Shane was doing, it was fine. But then this episode, this incident has come about because there was a chink of failure, and Jess Varnish and the team sprint, the women's sprint team for Rio didn't qualify. And that just opens an opportunity for someone to air their grievances, but also, more importantly, for people to listen. And Rich, you made the point before we recorded today that a similar, well, grievances have been aired before, but no one's been willing to listen. And that includes us, because, you know, we're all enjoying this great wave of success in some form or another. That doesn't mean we're getting rich off it, but it means that it gives us more opportunities to live our passion. There are more events taking place in the UK. There are more things happening. We feel like we're at the centre of the cycling world. And I said 3 or 4 weeks ago, after the very unfortunate death and the incident of when Antoine de Moitier tragically died at Gent-Wevelgem, that every now and again we need to be reminded of our responsibilities. And I think this needs to remind us of our responsibilities and everyone who is enjoying this wave that it shouldn't come at any price.
Yeah, but hang on a second, Daniel. I think that, you know, we've felt like we've known Shane. I don't think we were familiar with, you know, we can't really talk about the specific allegations, I suppose, but he's not used language like that in front of me, for example. I have not been aware of serious allegations of bullying, which is what he's accused of now. I think, you know, Shane is one of these people who, whether you're a journalist or a writer or anybody else, he keeps you on your toes. You know, he challenges you all the time. And sometimes he challenges you with humour. You know, sometimes, as in his text message to me, he challenges you more directly. But I don't think there's been, certainly on our part, a suspicion of anything particularly sinister going on. I had a text message from a coach who works in, who has worked in British Cycling this morning, and he, I think, sums up pretty well the situation, that Shane was always really good at his job. Being nice is probably a hindrance in that regard, he says. But he's not a good figurehead for a publicly funded organisation. In fact, Donald Trump would probably be a more diplomatic choice. And I think, you know, Shane, whatever his faults, and you know, he clearly has faults, there is a tendency, a rush to see people as either heroes or villains, isn't there? Especially in the social media age. And I think with Shane, I think all of us would have said that he's got some really strong points and some failings and some flaws. And you know, in the plus column, he is, and I think most people, even his critics, would agree, he is a fantastic coach, and his knowledge of cycling, his reading of a race, is, in my experience, second to none.
And it's worked for some and not for others. I mean, there are some athletes who have absolutely loved working under Shane Sutton, and for whom it's been perfect, and that includes women as well. I mean, I think you guys spoke to Becky James a few weeks ago, and she was very complimentary about his methods and the effect he's had on her. And, you know, we've lauded over the years in every sport, there have been great coaches whose very abrasive approach has been lauded. And sometimes it's a very fine line whereby it can tip into something more sinister. And, you know, as we've said, we need to see whether these allegations are verified and whether they're true. And if they are, it does seem that he's lurched into something that is completely unacceptable here.
I think the key thing about Shane Sutton being the top dog is the main issue. In the past, when he was the head coach and there was Dave Brailsford above, you know, there was somebody to go to. If the buck stops with Shane Sutton, this kind of language, this kind of behaviour, it takes another turn, because the sense for an athlete is that, well, that's the ultimate boss. There's nowhere to go beyond this. And so I think that also might be what has kind of pushed it out into the public domain. Whereas previously, perhaps, you know, conflicts and difficulties and, you know, something said in the heat of the moment could be smoothed over, particularly during an era when they were, you know, pretty much successful across the board. I think there's a real danger that we kind of lose sight of the fact that an elite sports team like the British Cycling Team, there are difficult decisions to be made. People not being selected for events that they built their whole adult lives around is a fact of life. It's just that there has to be an appropriate way of people interacting with each other. And on the face of it, some of the interactions between Shane Sutton and the athletes appears to be, pretty inappropriate, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier Becky James, Daniel. I mean, just maybe to finish this segment, unless you guys have got anything to add, but we'll no doubt return to it at some point. But, I did speak to Becky James a couple of weeks ago, and she, you know, she's had a terrible time with illness scares and injury and so on, and came back at the World Championships and won a medal, and that was felt like a gold medal for her. And she couldn't have been more positive about the role of Shane Sutton in supporting her. She said he was the only one who believed in her, and he really got behind her and put her back on track. Lizzie Armitstead, on the other hand, who I spoke to the other day, you know, it's not really part of the British system. She's done her own thing, and she made the point that she said there's been a clear strategy on the men's side, and a model that has obviously worked. And she said, I don't think there has been a clear strategy on the women's side, not at all. The best women we've had in this country have gone off and they've done it themselves. So, you know, I think she's pretty clear that that men and women have been treated differently by the governing body, and that, you know, is something that I think is the more important point. That there are two investigations now having been launched, and, you know, they will clearly look into Shane's conduct, but they should also perhaps look at the much wider and more important issue of whether the organisation is whether there are sort of institutional problems there with regard to how the men and the women and the Paralympians are treated. An addendum to our discussion about Shane Sutton and British Cycling: just after we'd finished recording, it was announced that Shane Sutton has resigned as technical director at British Cycling. So as I said earlier, this did escalate and develop very quickly in a way that few of us could have foreseen even a day ago. In his statement, Shane Sutton said that the developments over the past few days have clearly become a distraction. It is for this reason, and having spoken to friends and family, that I believe it is in the best interest of British Cycling for me to step down from my position as technical director. He has said that he will cooperate fully in the two investigations that British Cycling have launched.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Okay, no doubt we will return to Shane Sutton and British Cycling. That story is not going to go away. And we'll have lots of opportunity to return to that and many other stories, because we've got some exciting news, haven't we, chaps? Daniel, do you want to break the news?
Is this the news about us going to the Giro d'Italia, Rich?
Well done, Daniel. Yeah. You've remembered. Tell the listeners what kind of treats they're in line for.
They are in line for on the ground reporting. So daily podcast. We're going to do 9 kilometer zeros or documentary pieces. Most of our listeners will be familiar with those from last year's Tour de France, our recent Survivors of Spring series. I'm going to be teaching you about the mountains mainly. That's my main objective for the 3 weeks. Teaching you the difference between the Apennines, the Dolomites, the Alps, different sub ranges of the Alps. Teaching you when it's appropriate to drink cappuccino, what to order on your pizza, that kind of thing. And we'll be seeing a lot of Chiro. Chiro is on the race, crucially.
A lot of Chiro. No Chiro, no Giro. And it's the first time that we've covered the Giro like this. We were all at start in Belfast a couple of years ago, but this is the first time we've basically given the Giro the Tour de France treatment and gone there and, you know, covered it with daily shows. And we're going there purely and exclusively for the podcast, and we're very much looking forward to it, aren't we, fellows? So that'll be fun. A little reminder that we have just released our latest Friends special. That is a little trip I took to Nice to meet up with Ian Boswell of Team Sky, Joe Dombrowski of Cannondale, and Larry Warbass of I Am Cycling. And you can become a friend of the podcast at thiscyclingpodcast.com for £10 for the year for 11 special episodes, and maybe some extras as well to be announced at later dates. But thanks very much for all the positive reaction to the latest episode, Young Americans. Unfortunately, we don't have any David Bowie in there. The rights were, we don't have quite as many friends as we need to justify paying for the rights to use his music. But it's gone down very well, and people seem to have enjoyed hearing these guys really open up and talk about what it's like to be a pro. In this extract, we hear from Ian Boswell, the Team Sky rider, who explains how he managed to get a contract extension with the team.
It was like being in high school again. I gave a PowerPoint presentation. Yeah, I used all my skills that I took in
Us through this
in high school computers class. But no, I actually I was actually on vacation in Thailand, of all places, after the 2014 season. And I was thinking, okay, this is a contract year. It's a big year. You know, how do I kind of guarantee that I'm in the world tour, have a contract at all, and, ideally stay at Sky. And so Dave and I had talked a little bit just on, kind of what I'd done. And, he kind of wanted me to review myself and see, looking back at the last 2 years, judge myself on, a multitude of categories, your position in the peloton, your lifestyle, your happiness, your, morale going into races, your training, nutrition, body composition, just kind of a various array of kind of spanning all your life and your career. And then based off that, I figured, talking to my friend Pete here in Nice, to put together a PowerPoint presentation. It was a very business-like PowerPoint presentation. There was goals that, I had direct control over, because the thing in cycling is I could say, set your goals and you want to do this race and you want to get this result, but I don't necessarily have control over those. If you set your goal to, win a stage of Tour of California and then you don't even go to California because you're sick or you're injured or you're not on the team, you're setting yourself goals that aren't even obtainable.
Who was there when you gave the presentation? Where did it happen? Set the scene.
So I was out in Mallorca at the Vanity Hotel where we always are. And I started the presentation, I think, initially Dave was kind of blown away. So I actually
were you wearing a
suit? I wasn't wearing a suit, no. But I'm not very known for my style. I started the presentation, went through, I think, one or two slides, and then Dave made me stop the presentation to bring in the rest of the performance staff. So it was just, originally it was Dave, Dario Cioni, and myself, and I think Sean Stevens, who was a coach on Sky at the time. So he made me stop the presentation, and then I think Simon Jones came in, Tim Carrison, and maybe
a few
others.
Was that quite nerve-wracking?
Yeah, it was, because, it's like when you're doing a presentation, I guess, in high school as well, you get nervous, and, especially going over something again that you've just talked about. And I think, at the time I was thinking I was giving a presentation for the team and to kind of please them. But looking back on it at the end of last year, I realized that it was it was for them, but it benefited me the most. And just having goals at the beginning of the year that I could track myself and my performance, and I kind of constantly had a measurement of where I was at and where I expected myself to be and where, how I was matching up to that.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by sigmasport.co.uk, the UK's leading road cycling store. Use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout to receive £10 off your next order of £50 or more.
Okay, you heard there our extended sigmasport.co.uk jingle. Thank you very much to Sigma Sport for their sponsorship. We're still getting really good feedback from listeners to the podcast who are obviously customers, old and new, of Sigma Sport. I'd give you a little bit of information about the shop and the online mail order business last week. But it's been a really good partnership with them. They've sponsored us throughout April. And who knows, we might hook up with them again. We hope so, because they're cyclists, and we like cyclists, and they like cyclists too. So thank you very much to Sigma Sport. And before that, you heard a clip from Young Americans featuring Joe Dombrowski, Ian Boswell, Larry Warbass. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. So we've got a few other things to discuss, haven't we? Daniel, you were being very provocative the other night, tweeting lots of extracts from Danilo De Luca's new book.
Lionel is being very provocative by introducing his cat to the podcast. I've just seen his cat appear. What's its name, Lionel?
Arthur. Arthur Visho.
Arthur. Excellent, excellent. I was being very provocative, Richard, very unlike me, I know. I spent the weekend, it took me about 8 hours, actually. I raced through it, the autobiography of Danilo De Luca. Now, as I pointed out on Twitter, I'm not intend to promote this. I know that with good reason, a lot of listeners take exception to bike riders doping, cheating throughout their career, and then cashing in with autobiographies. Danilo De Luca is not the first person to have done it, but it's actually, to my surprise, a cracking read. I would say a gripping chronicle of self-destruction. De Luca, of course, he was the Giro d'Italia winner in 2007, very much a fixture in a very thriving Italian cycling scene, not unlike the British scene at the moment. No, that's where the parallels end. In the late 1990s and the last decade, so 2000 to 2010, De Luca got in a lot of hot water as far as doping was concerned. Doped from, well, his amateur days. There was a first round of quotes that went round which suggested he'd admitted to having started doping in 2001. That was actually a bit misleading. He did actually start doping before he turned pro in 1997, and he only started the serious stuff, is how he described it, in 2001. But really, by the sounds of his book, he was on the serious stuff pretty much 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year throughout his career, and really shameless about it. I mean, his argument is that it was impossible to compete without it. And in spite of having admitted doping throughout his career, still harbours a real persecution complex. He still thinks that he started his career with a small team, Cantina Tolo. He was desperate to go to the big Mapei team, but because mainly he felt that the Mapei riders were protected, they would never test positive, etc., etc., didn't get that break. And he feels that he was persecuted throughout his career, that basically other people's tests were being covered up and his were not. But really, the most interesting parts of the book are about his personal life and about, in particular, his marriage breakup, I think. I mean, he was one half of the sort of golden couple of Italian cycling with a lady called Valentina Giuliani, who is the daughter of a direct sportif, Stefano Giuliani. And they would always be on Italian TV, in the Gazzetta dello Sport. And really fascinating just the way that relationship broke up and his infidelities and how, again, unapologetic he almost was about those. And really, he makes no bones about the fact that he's written this book. Well, he's in a very precarious, or he has been in a very precarious financial position since the last of his positive tests in 2013. And it's a sort of gripping, no holds barred account, really. I would say halfway between a sort of, it's kind of like a David Miller with more sex and without the contrition. And it stops some way short of Tyler Hamilton as far as the doping is concerned, but probably a bit more of a bodice ripper than the Tyler Hamilton book.
I think you're in line to get a quote there on the jacket of any paperback edition or English language edition, Daniel. It sounds interesting, but as you know, I mentioned earlier with regard to Shane Sutton, the rush to the urge to paint people as either heroes or villains, and you know, I never buy that. I think people are far more complicated and far more interesting than that. And this is not to launch any kind of defense of Danilo De Luca at all, but there's a fascinating little portrait of him in Charlie Wigelius's book Domestique, which you know shows you a completely different side to him and reveals that he's more than just this unrepentant doper, which he clearly is. But you know, if you're, and again, this sort of relates a little bit to the Shane Sutton story. If you're not, if you're a teammate of his, as Charlie Wigelius was, and he's your leader and your captain, and he treats you extremely well, you know, your view of him is likely to be coloured by that. And likewise, if you work with Shane Sutton, or if you have dealings with Shane Sutton, and he doesn't bully you and he doesn't abuse you, then that colours your view of him.
Indeed, Richard, and I did think back to Charlie's book, because I think Charlie talks about how sort of one-dimensional De Luca was, in the sense that he only really lived for the Giro d'Italia. And the Giro d'Italia in the book is really a prism, or it's a catalyst for all the most important events in his career. It's, you know, where he had his big breakthrough in 1999. It's where he cheated on a podium girl in 2000 and, Or he cheated with a podium girl, sorry, in 2006. And he said that was the moment where it all started to go wrong for him. And then his relationship with his wife carried on for another few years. And then his wife, there's a scene, I mean, she visited him at the race in 2011 and waited for him outside the team bus. This was stage, I think, 13, if anyone wants to look it up, where he finished that day. But she actually told him outside the bus as he was on his way to sign on that day that she was leaving him and then they would get a divorce.
Wow. Well, we've got one other sort of current issue to discuss, and that's Sergio Henao, which we didn't mention in the roundup. But Sergio Henao has UCI have basically the anti-doping division of the UCI CADF have launched an inquiry into Sergio Henao's apparently irregular blood values. This is something that has been flagged up before by Team Sky, who sidelined him for a bit while they carried out their own investigation, and they were satisfied that any irregularities owed to the fact that he's an altitude native and this was playing havoc with his blood values. That's not a scientific term, but it was certainly having some kind of effect on his blood values and wasn't necessarily indicative of doping, or certainly they thought it wasn't indicative of doping. But, you know, anti-doping body at UCI have now launched an inquiry. He's got 20 days to respond, and then we will see what happens. Nothing might happen, or action may be taken, or proceedings may be opened against Sergio Henao. We don't know.
It is a strange one, Richard, and although Team Sky publicly backed Henao, I would speculate that they are perhaps not. They're probably 90-something percent confident, but they themselves will be very interested to see what the UCI say, because I think, you know, Sky have their own independent experts that look at the biological passports. They even look at biological passports of riders they are interested in signing, and they draw their conclusions, but they might not necessarily be the same conclusions of the UCI biological passport panel. And, you know, this is something that team managers have complained to us about before. They've asked the UCI at times, you know, what are the parameters? What should we look for? What should we be careful of? What should we be circumspect about when it comes to signing riders? And the UCI have not told them. And the UCI's argument for not doing that is that they don't want to provide basically a how-to manual to teams of how to dodge the biological passport. So it's a tricky one. And Sky have, well, there's this independent study going on in Sheffield. And again, that sort of raises questions. An independent study, is it based on just one person? Well, there aren't many independent studies, scientific papers that will take a sample size of one. So, but, you know, I think you've tried to contact the University of Sheffield in the last couple of days, Rich. I've contacted or tried to contact Henao's agent, Giuseppe Acquadro. He's been uncontactable for a couple of days now. But, you know, really it's in everyone's interest that there's as much transparency as possible here. And I think Sky almost needs to be a bit bloody-minded about it. And I think they've been stung by so much criticism and so much violent reaction on social media. And this applied to last year's Tour de France as well, when they came out, Tim Kerrison came out with the figures of Chris Froome's performances. And I think they've almost been, well, they're very scared of releasing too much now because they're scared of the reaction. But I think they almost need to just batten down the hatches and kind of ignore all of that noise and do what they think is right and do what they think is ethical. And if that means being completely transparent and releasing all the data, that's what they need to do and sod the consequences, really.
Yeah, I tried to get a chat with Eddie Hampton at the University of Sheffield, has been leading the study. It is, as you say, ongoing. I think, you know, for it to have any chance of being published in a scientific journal, it needs to be more than, you know, a paper looking at the blood values of a Colombian cyclist called Sergio Henao. But his, you know, what they have done and the studies they have carried out into Henao and looking at the topic more widely will form part of Henao's defence, if you like. So he's going to be busy with that over the next couple of weeks and doesn't want to speak to the media at the moment, partly because he's busy. But maybe at some point in the future, we'll be able to speak to him and get a greater understanding of, you know, exactly what the issue might be for altitude natives and indeed other ethnic groups as well. You know, as you say, Daniel, we don't know what the biological passport experts are really looking for, and they're perfectly perhaps valid reasons for that. But, you know, how much the pool of riders in professional cycling is pretty it's pretty limited in terms of the ethnic pool. And, you know, do other people from other parts of the world who live in other places, do they have different physiological profiles? We perhaps don't know. Well, I certainly don't know, and it'd be interesting to know how much they know.
And just a final word on the passport, Rich. I, again, to go back to De Luca and his book, and make of this what you will, take it with a pinch of salt if you will, but De Luca's opinion of the biological passport was that it had been very useful primarily to stop riders killing themselves, but not as a control mechanism. He said that all you needed to do to get around the biological passport was to dope very regularly, so there are no clear anomalies. Now, I would reiterate, this is a guy who tested positive 3 times and was the first cyclist, I think I'm right in saying, ever to be banned for life.
Should we wrap up there, chaps? We've covered quite a lot of ground today. We've got a big week ahead of us preparing for the Giro, and we're very much looking forward to that. A little reminder that we've released 3 of our kilometer zeros for spring, sponsored by Wellbricks. Go to wellbricks.com and back the Kickstarter campaign, because the Wellbricks, which is a massage brick, if you're interested in, what do you call it, Daniel? Trigger massage, is that
trigger
right?
Trigger point massage, Richard.
Okay, sorry. But I used to use a foam roller. The advantage of the Wellbricks is they're very transportable, so they come highly recommended, not least by Marco Pinotti, who is a big fan. So we've released 3 of the Wellbricks Kilometer Zeros so far. One more to come, and that is my day with Canyon SRAM at Women's Flesh Wallonne last week. That'll be out next week. Look out for that, and go to wellbricks.com and fund Caroline's Kickstarter campaign. That'd be great. That's all for this week. As I say, we'll be back next week with a Giro preview, and we'll be en route to Holland and the start of the Giro d'Italia to bring you daily shows. For now, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Lionel. Thank you, Lionel's cats.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.